Hello and welcome to the Bot Nirvana podcast, where we dive into all things software automation. I'm your host, Nandan Mullakra. While I'm not podcasting, I write articles on nandan.info. I hope you enjoy the show. Let's get right into it. On our podcast today, we have Alex Hubel. He is the Chief Strategy Officer and co-owner of Turbotic. Before Turbotic, Alex headed up Ericsson's global automation and AI organizations. In this chat, we explore how he set up the automation COE at Ericsson and how they scaled it, resulting in millions of hours saved across all parts of the company. We discuss how these learnings led to the formation of Turbotic and why automation optimization is important for a successful intelligent automation program. Let's listen in. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the Bot Nirvana podcast. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Can we start with a quick intro about yourself?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Nanda, for having me today. I'm looking forward. I think you do a really good podcast here. Short intro. I'm Alex. I'm maybe first and foremost a father of two, soon three. live in Sweden. Professionally, I've been in the intelligent automation space for quite a while, 6-7 years now, I think. Before that, working with transformation my whole career as a management consultant, internally in with the strategy execution, digital transformation. I've been a kind of intrapreneur doing inception of intelligent automation. I've been more of an entrepreneur, working from the early stages of a startup and into, you know, the growth phase that we are in currently, but still in the intelligent automation space, which is close to my heart.
That's great to know. And I know you've been active in the space, talking about the challenges, especially in terms of operations and automation optimization with Turbotic, right? So can you tell us a bit about how Turbotic came out to be?
So we were running intelligent automation at, I would say, a very big scale at the Swedish telco giant Ericsson for many years. And at that point of time, you know, Theo is the CEO of Turbotic. He was also at Ericsson, and we were really struggling with certain things when running intelligent automation, and we thought, shouldn't there be some product to solve these things? Because we kept spending time and energy trying to figure out, you know, what business value have we generated? How does the pipeline look like? Why is the operations cost so high? Are the bots even running? Those kind of things. We spend a lot of time trying to get information about and trying to report to various stakeholders and executives and others who needed the information. And we thought, you know, there's not a glue that keeps this together. There's not a system for COEs that they can run their intelligent automation program in, where they can optimize their operations and digitize their end-to-end life cycle. So we thought, let's create this product that we thought we were missing in the market. And here we are now. It's 2.5 almost years later. So it's been a good journey so far, but it's still early days in this space.
Yeah, pretty exciting space, I think so too. Let's just talk about your Ericsson time, because that seems to be an exciting place that you guys set up a center of excellence and then grew it, right? So can you tell us a bit about, the COE, how you established it, how you started running it, what were the challenges, what was your learnings?
Yeah. Definitely. I think we were a bit lucky to be at the right place at the right time, when these kind of questions with RPA and other AI questions started to emerge more as trending topics around 2016, in that time span. So I think, like many others, we found out about these technologies. I have my background in the outsourcing advisory industry. So for me, like many others actually in this space, I think we quite early saw the potential of basically replacing all the manual labor. We were shifting it from, you know, Europe and US often to India in many cases and other emerging markets. But now we saw the same work that we were, you know, doing lift and shift through outsourcing and offshoring, you could basically do with a robot. So that was what caught my interest in these technologies. I was working with digital transformation strategies and so on at the time, and based on that, we could, you know, find a couple of good use cases where we could try out these kind of technologies in shared services type of settings, and those were really going really, really well, even if they were going really, really slow, like onboarding new types of technologies into a large enterprise. But based on that, we could start to sketch on how do we scale this, and how do we create maximum business value out of these kind of technologies. It was obviously that it was not a technology game, it was a business transformation game. So we designed the business transformation program and a kind of a COE, or as we call it, solution area that could support such a business transformation, where we leverage not only RPA but, you know, all these new emerging technologies, AI and process mining and IDP and other things that started to become popular in 2016 and 2017. So basically, we outlined a plan. We went up to the executive team and almost promised quite big savings. We're allowed to do quite big investments, both in hiring people and, you know, spending project budget and start to build this whole ship, you can say. So that was how all of that started.
Oh, okay, excellent. And so, yeah, my background is also outsourcing. I used to go on the vendor side. I was at Fujitsu, and yeah, you know, we were doing outsourcing. And how I got interested in this space is also through understanding that there is leverage in automating things, and not just outsourcing, because that was offshoring was getting, it was something everyone was doing, and as well as it was getting a little bit more costlier, and things were not as much saving as earlier. So, and you could control it better. So, yeah, so that's an interesting, we have some similar things. As you established this center of excellence, I don't know, you called it by some other name, I think solution space or something. What did you say?
We call it solutionary because we had to fit into the common methodology that were existing within Ericsson at that time. So yeah, we created a new solution area basically, which was basically a big team in IT that is owning some, you know, technology area end to end.
Yeah, and so that also shows, you know, these terms are not important. Like, you know, people are stuck on center of excellence. So the idea is that there is a group of people who are focused on making automation better.
Exactly.
Automation, doing automation as an expertise for the organization. So as you established the center of excellence, you went to your management with the benefits. How did you do that? How did you pull it off? And what was your learning as you went through it? Did you actually achieve those things that you promised? And how did that progress?
It sounds very simple, but obviously there was a lot of, you know, politics around those kind of things. But we managed to get a slot at one of these like executive for us top 200 where we could present this and say, you know, hey, we can do huge savings with this. We didn't really know, we only did a few bots, but that caught a lot of interest and enough like focus, and so we could invest, and we politically established this within IT to avoid turf wars so that the CIO had, you know, kind of a piece of the cake here and could drive this with the overall like IT digitalization strategy. So, but I think the lucky thing when we started more from a business perspective, more from a transformation perspective, not from an IT perspective, I think in hindsight, was that we put these investments more into business transformation and less into hiring developers, for instance. That I see many companies do. Even if they get a sum, they get X dollars, and they get, you know, what, 10 headcounts, and then they hire 8 developers and one head and one guy to lead the projects. We did totally the opposite. We hired 8 people to go out and engage the business, and one guy to project manage vendors that were building that were building stuff. So we totally shifted the model towards being close to the business and like embedding these capabilities as a strategic transformation capability in all the functions and all the business units that there was. And in that way, we could have like discussions on much more senior discussions, and we could, instead of doing like small projects somewhere, we could say, hey, let's go down to this center where we know we have 1,000 people doing manual work. Let's map all the processes that they are doing. And let's come up with a bigger transformation plan on how to kind of automate, not all, but, you know, vast part of that work. So, and when you do that, after a while, then you get good business cases. So then it's not so hard to get funding to actually bring in developers, be it internal, you know, hires, or be it consultants to develop these solutions. But what I see that many companies do, they do the opposite. They hire developers and then they create an intake app and they wait for someone to, you know, come come with ideas on what they should do, and they have one person engaging the business. And I think that's okay. I mean, then you can keep 10 people occupied, but if you want to scale, we were, in the end when I left, we were 500 people doing this. If you want to scale, then you kind of need to rethink that model and do it the opposite way. And then after a while, obviously, you can hire lots of developers and you can build, you know, focus on technical things and platforms and so on. But that can wait until you have until you have like the business with you, I think.
That's an excellent point that you made, because the model that most of the people are following is the usual IT model, right? There is some person going and get requirement, then there's a ton of developers developing that and throwing it across the wall and hoping that it sticks. And in the old days, it was more like you have to take it. I mean, this, we are IT, we know what you need, and you take it, right? But right now, you know, things are changing. Technology is like, you know, is very much in part of the business. And so, and RPA, I think, is that RPA or this automation that we're talking about is somewhere in the transition phase where, you know, technology is becoming more and more imbibed in the business. And we have seen that. I mean, you know, it resonates more with the business than with IT. And like you said, you know, IT generally ends up with turf war. So I see a great strategy there where you were part of the IT, but you were engaging the business more. You were front loading on business people, business analysts, so that you can get the use cases or automation ideas before you bring in the people to develop things. So I think that's a great learning for people who are listening. You know, you should, within RPA space, this is probably a best practice, is to first be very attuned to the business and have resources who are focused on the business, who can get you the automation use cases, right? So you got the automation use cases, then you brought in the developers. So you did say that you went up to 500 people. So can you fill us out into how you went from, you know, maybe like a 20 member team to a 500 member team, and what was that journey? How did this structure evolve between business people and developers, and how did you manage to scale it to such a big number?
Yeah, thanks. That's a good question. And but we wanted to create maximum value for the company. We had an ambition to really scale, and we saw, you know, there are so many exciting technologies coming in.
Right.
And in order to justify investments into these platforms, we had to have pretty high volume, because onboarding one platform cost $1 million or $2 million or more, right? And then you need a lot in the kind of this world with RPA and process mining. So you need a big volume of opportunities. You will never get that if you sit and wait for someone to come up with these opportunities. You need to go out there, educate people, place this, you know, strategically with the business, and tell them, you know, in this case, how much can you save, or how much can you reduce your lead time, or how much working capital can you reduce, or whatever is the important business metric. And the way we structure ourselves to do that. We created one team that focused only on engaging business transformation. So there we filled with like management consulting types who went out with, to the business, and also you know, senior people from the business that already knew everybody within the business and had relationships. And we they were basically tasked with helping the business get business value from these, including finding opportunities and analyzing opportunities. But if they get down and dirty analyzing opportunities, they can't focus on, you know, having conversations with the CFO and that person's team. So we provided them with, you know, budgets so that they could bring in business analysts when they needed. You might not need five business analysts always, but when you have a big project, say, hey, now we need to go down to India or Bulgaria or something and look at all these processes, then you need that. So then we could bring in people with budgets, and then we had another team focused on building, you know, more like a traditional operating model. The technical things. How do you build the bots that are stable? How do you build bots in, you know, 2 weeks instead of 10 weeks? How do you operate these bots? How do you manage your different platforms, and so on? And they were focusing on the to what is traditionally done in a COE, basically building and operating bots. And then we had a third team, I would say, different programs who were only looking at emerging technology. So they were tasked with, you know, finding new emerging technology, setting up to kind of proof of concepts, and finding out, okay, what's the best model to use to scale these technologies. So while scaling RPA, for instance, we set up these kind of programs for machine learning and for IDP and for process mining and so on. So we had multiple of these programs running in like an inception phase while scaling RPA. And after a while, all of them became like ready. So then we embedded them into the overall operating model. We gave these transformation guys, you know, a bigger portfolio to sell to the business. And we hired more like skilled IT project managers and so on to actually build these solutions and use these products to create value. So that is how we did that. And after a while, even if we started with RPA, that was in 2016, that was 100% of the whole business, so to say. Maybe in 2021, it was 10%. So that is also, in that way, we could basically scale a lot of different technologies and combine them into hyper-automation early on. But one key aspect on how we could do that, because this obviously cost too much, if all of this would have been taken on the CIO budget, it would never have happened. So we were totally dependent on this transformation team finding money in the business.
Okay.
Continuously. So each and every project was business funded. And then we did some smart subsidized, like operating bots we made free, so that no one got the, you know, idea that I should also operate bots. And no, we do that for free for you. It's better. Otherwise, you get these islands of, you know, smaller COEs that is not scaling. So we avoided that by playing with the financial model, but you know, allowing the business, they could invest 100 million or 10 million or 1 million. They could invest how much they wanted, and then we could scale indefinitely since we had vendor contracts. So if we wanted, you know, a team in Japan starting next week, we could get that from the vendor. But if we would have hired everybody, all developers and so on, we could that, then you can't scale that fast, and you need to hire people and manage it. So we had always had vendors supporting this journey, not with the strategic roles, but just with the operational roles of building bots and analyzing processes and so on.
Okay, excellent. And so I just wanted to you know, double click on that organization that you had. So you had three teams there. So one you're calling the business transformation team, which had the management consultants, and were the BAs also part of that team, or were they part of the operations team?
The BAs were more like in a shared pool, so okay. they could be bought by this transformation team, but they could also be shared and across the different engagements that we were
Okay.
We were running. So yeah, there was a, and over time we started to build up a quite big, you know, then after a while, lots of the BAs and developers, they were in-house.
Okay.
Which worked fine, so to say, but they were more, you know, allocated different projects or different engagements or different programs for shorter or temporary time limits, while these other, the transformation, they were the kind of key account managers for the different business business units, you can say.
Yeah, so you actually had like an account managers who were the management consulting type, who were working with the business to get the automation processes as well as the budget, which would feed the developer BA project manager team who were building the bots and churning them out. And then you also had a center of competencies, I understand, where you were building competencies for machine learning and everything.
Exactly. So even if I didn't talk so much about it, we worked a lot on like how do you build a bot in a good way, and how do you operate this, and how do you, when we started with low code, how do you build these lifestyle guys and so on. So we worked a lot with these things too. It's just that we did it a bit more, not as the kind of strategic priorities, but more as a way to operationalize the kind of the intelligent automation journey, you can say.
Okay, yeah, and so you have three teams, and you know, and I would say mostly two teams, one competency center, but mostly two teams. One is a business team as well as the operations team, which is taking care of this, and then you need something to coordinate that, right? Like you need to load it up, you need to load up all the automation ideas coming in into a pipeline, take it through this whole journey from, you know, development to testing to release. And so I think that's where you were thinking, okay, yeah, this is a tool that we need, right? Yeah. And that's how you came about with Turbotic that you are talking about. So,
exactly.
You want to expand on that a bit?
No, right. I mean, and I was also at that time going around a lot, talking at different conferences and so about intelligent automation. And what we saw, there's a quite clear life cycle for this. And it was more or less the same for all of these technologies, right? You have an ideation phase, you need to find ideas, there are different ways to do that. Then you need to do some discovery project where you analyze these opportunities and you design a solution. It might be RPA, or it might be AI, or it might be low code, or RPA plus AI, or whatever. And then you build that thing, and then which was often costly. I mean, that consumed a lot of these budgets, and that was the budgets we got from the from the business, right? So that we had to, you know, keep track of these projects, that they were on time, on budget, on cost, and that was really hard.
Yeah.
And then it was operations when you deployed. We had such a scale, and we couldn't do like full DevOps. We had the centralized operations, partly like first line support and so on. And there, I think that was a bit problematic, because we added more and more bots and more solutions, and then we had no solution to the problem. So we were just throwing people at the problem, and the people were in India, and we were not paying so much for them. So it wasn't that expensive adding one more person, but in the end we had a lot of people, right? And then it was quite expensive. So the whole run cost kept growing, and I think that was fine as long as the budgets, you know, were increasing. But if you get to a point where maybe like many companies face now in an economic downturn, you will likely not be allowed to have your budget increased, especially not if you are in IT, because the CIO budget will likely decrease, and especially the run part of the of that budget. So you have to start thinking, but how do you optimize this? Just throwing more people and adding more and more license costs and adding more infra resources, that is not sustainable. And then, as you said, how do you get this all together, and how do you understand what value you are generating? Because in the end, you know, if you generate $1 billion in value, it's probably fine to have $100 million of cost being added. But if you can't show that you're adding that value, then you'll have a very hard time scaling and being allowed to let the cost increase. So we invested quite a lot in being able to track this value, and which was very time consuming and very manual very manual effort, right? And we had different Excel sheets and Jira boards and blah blah to do that.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was the reality we were living in, and that is what I saw that many other big companies were also living in. There was nothing available in the market to solve this. So we got the idea to start Trobotic and try to solve these problems. So how do you create both a product that can help you orchestrate and optimize operations, so that instead of your curve going like this, maybe it goes like this, right? you can keep the control of the cost as you're scaling intelligent automation.
Right.
And secondly, how do you get much better visibility of the whole life cycle?
Yeah.
And not having a pipeline in Excel and a project board in Jira and three different orchestrators that you keep, operating stuff in, and a very mess for someone trying to figure out how it's actually going.
Yeah. And, I think that's a great point you made about visibility, because, this is one of the things that people who are starting out as they start ramping up miss, is that visibility is lost. And then, it's all over the place with Excel sheets, like you said, or, multiple tools, which, you don't get a clear view of what's happening, but things are happening, right?
Exactly.
So I think from your perspective, I think, that I do still see people doing those things, and this is really a tool that can bridge that gap, or which can actually solve that problem, basically. So fast forwarding so many years, 2.5 years now, how has the industry received your offering, and where are you finding good traction?
Good. So we are just starting year three in the life of this company. So if the first year was a lot about building a prototype, having a beta program, getting, first customers, second year was a lot about setting an operating model where we can scale and investing a lot in the product to make it fully, what should I say, have a full product market fit.
Mm-hmm.
Year three is now really about, scaling across the globe. And now I think we're well positioned, since we've set up business we're starting in Sweden, so we can reach Europe from Sweden. We set up in India very early on, so we can reach the whole APAC market and the GCC market and the GSI market through India, and then US lately, where we now have a number of customers, and we will especially grow both sales and marketing capabilities. We believe US will be our main market, single biggest individual market for us. We'll keep, of course, investing in Europe and Asia too, but, focus much, much more on US in 2023. So I think earlier, now we have to explain much less on what this is and what we do. Some people start to know what this is. We see some competition popping up in parts which we didn't at all see, year one. So the market is awakening up. We also see some research agencies starting to write about this this category. We are trying to kind of create a new category here, which we have decided to call automation optimization.
Right.
But others might call it, orchestration or management and so on. So I think more and more people in this automation industry are starting to get a better understanding of this problem, which was easy to see from my perspective earlier at Ericsson, and other big implementations have seen this, because they have built their own orchestrators often. They built homegrown solutions to manage this, because you can't survive without it, basically. But now also, smaller implementations start to understand, if I don't take care of, if I don't do this in a structured way, if I don't get, control over my operations fairly early on, I risk sitting in a position like where many companies are, they did a lot of bots and so on, maybe not so good bots. And after a while, 60% of their people are just looking at error logs and trying to fix problems and so on. So then they can't. And with a budget cut on that, then you can, then you're, I would say you're not dead, but you'll have a really hard time scaling intelligent automation from that position. So that's good. It's easier and easier, I think. We see very big customers, but we also see the mid-size customers. They have 20 bots or so. They are starting to look at these kind of solutions.
Okay. Yeah, excellent. And you know, this task automation, I think to me, there are, you know, three kinds of orchestration, which is one is the orchestration that comes with the bot providers, you know, whether it's UiPath or Automation Anywhere, which is just managing their side and is limited. And then there is the orchestration where, let's say I have multiple providers and then I need to orchestrate across them between Blue Prism and UiPath because, you know, they're, each tool has its own merits, and so you're using different tools. And I see many organizations do that as they scale. And then there is also this bigger question, which I think is more important, is, you know, as you said, you know, as more technologies come in, like AI, ML, or chatbots, how do you orchestrate or manage across those things, right? So I like your term of automation management too, actually, because it's managing all these things, which can really get out of it. So you have a good you know, control, or you have a good view into what is happening. And I think that's the, as people scale, I think that's something everyone should consider in terms of how they are going to manage and probably keep optimizing their solution. So yeah, automation optimization. So before we go, Alex, how can people sign up for Turbotic and probably get started? Where can people find you and want, if they want to contact you?
Yeah, I would recommend it to send an email to me or connect on on LinkedIn. We still don't have like a digital version that you can download and get going. We're working on that now with Microsoft, so we hope to be it on Azure as a transactable offer in a while. But in the meantime, please feel free to reach out. We help companies with doing proof of concepts and doing trial deals, so to say, so you can, you know, easily try out and see if this is good for you and if you want to take a next step.
Excellent. So would you be another company on Azure like ChatGPT? You said you're working with Microsoft.
Yeah. Exactly. We have been part of Microsoft startup program since we started the program. So we are a partner with Microsoft. We are on Azure on the marketplace. Okay. Right now, the only thing is that you can't buy Turbotic from Microsoft today, but that hopefully you can do soon.
In the future. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you so much, Alex. This was a great chat. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Nandan. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining the Bot Nirvana podcast. Appreciate if you can leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Catch the show notes on botnirvana.org. While you're there, feel free to explore more automation ideas, tutorials, tools, and more. See you next time.